إن سألتم عن الله فهو رحمن رحيم، أنزل الشارع حنيفا رحمة للعالمين، رحمة للعالمين. إن سألتم عن كتابي فهو قرآن كريم، ضم دستور الحياة وحوى نور المبين، وحوى نور المبين. If you ask me who my God is, on whose name I call, if you ask me who my God is, he's the God.
Thank you very much.
In
the name of God, the ever merciful, the ever generous. I began by praising God and sending peace and salutations upon all of the prophets of God, from Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses and Jesus and the Prophet Muhammad. May God's peace and blessings be upon all of them. Now, I'd like to first of all put you all at ease by saying I have no prepared speech, no notes in front of me, no hidden agenda here at all. I'm just here to spend the next 20 minutes of hopefully very scintillating conversation with you, where after that then we'll open up the floor for interaction and open Q&A. I believe that's really the best way to introduce one another and to introduce our religion is merely to let things take their course, as we do in any conversation where if you meet somebody, you let things take their course. The topic that was assigned to me is, what exactly is the purpose of life? And this is a question that every single human being thinks about in the course of his or her life. It is a question that is the most fundamental of all questions. I don't think that any question could even come close to being as important as this question is. I mean, why are we here? Why did God create us? What is the purpose of life? People have given many different responses to this question. Different religions give different responses. For some religions, the purpose of life is the destruction of the self. For others, it is to curb one's ego and one's desires. You have to basically make sure that you have no desires, and when you have destroyed your own desires, you have reached nirvana. Other religions state that the purpose of life is to serve mankind and to do good to them. And the better you are to man, the better you are in your religion. What is the response of Islam? What do Muslims say is the purpose of life? Well, the Quran has some very explicit verses in this regard. In fact, the purpose of life is unequivocal. It is so explicit. There can be no two opinions about this issue. For the Quran states, in one of these verses, the Quran states that God speaks and He says, I have not created man for any other purpose except. So God has negated every purpose that any person can possibly think of. I have not created man for any purpose except that man worships me. The purpose of creation is the worship of God. And there can be no more noble, no more dignified, no more exalted purpose for life than the worship of God. So the purpose of life for the Muslim is the worship of God. There is no ultimate reason for existence other than to adore, to venerate, to worship this God who has created us. And this shows us, or this leads us to a very interesting point about the Quran. And that is that the Quran, unlike many books of theology, does not discuss the concept of proving the existence of a God very much. There are one or two verses where God says that, you know, he talks to those who deny him, basically atheists. But it is not a central point of Islamic theology proving the existence of God. Rather, the primary message of the Quran is to unify this God in our worship and not to prove that He exists. It's a very profound difference. If you let this point sink in, the average book of Christian theology, Jewish theology, Islamic theology that is meant for non-believers, the first chapter is, how do we know there's a God? How can we prove there is a God? Philosophers from time immemorial, from Aristotle, the prime mover, the unmoved mover, Socrates, Plato, you know, all of these different philosophers, Dante, everyone had their own, of course some of them denied God like Nietzsche and others, but the question was there, is there a God? If there is, how do we know He exists? Amazingly, the Quran hardly mentions this point. And the reason, the Quran itself says that the existence of God is so self-evident that to deny it really It is a type of lunacy, to be honest. To deny that a God exists, you look around you, you see the perfection, the beauty of creation. And to claim that there was nothing, and then a big bang, and voila, here we are. To claim that, you are denying something that is brighter than the sun at midday. If somebody were to come to you and say, I don't believe the sun is shining right now. How long would you debate with him and try to prove that the sun is shining? I don't think many of us would spend more than 5-10 minutes. It's like, if you're not going to believe the sun is shining, I don't know how to prove this to you. It's so self-evident and obvious. Well, for us as Muslims, the proof that the sun has a creator is clearer and brighter than the proof that the sun is shining in the day. Because God created the sun and all that is around the sun, including us. Life itself, the miracle of life. To claim that we have been created from nothing, really, it boggles the mind. We don't live our lives like that. Nothing happens except that we know there's a cause behind it. If I come home and I find the furniture has been rearranged, I find my pen has been moved from point A to point B, I don't say there was a big bang and it happened. I don't say there was a chance. I know somebody was there. There was a cause that caused this effect to occur. There was something that happened that caused this change. And to presume that this entire creation, the perfection with which it exists, what we call nature, to presume this came out of naught, out of nothing, and the harmony, no matter what science you study, be it biology, be it physics, be it chemistry, you're just amazed at the perfection of everything. And what is more amazing is that all of these sciences are actually interconnected. We, in our limited minds, can only specialize in one subfield. If I were to do my PhD in chemistry, I couldn't even specialize in chemistry. I'd have to go specialize within a sub-branch, of a sub-branch in chemistry. And my entire life would be dedicated to this one subfield. Hundreds of thousands of academics are all specializing in all these subfields of the natural sciences. The reality is they're all interrelated, they're all interconnected. And that is the world as we know it. And to claim that all of this is chance, everything is so perfect. From the air that we breathe, 79% nitrogen, 21% oxygen. If the percentage of oxygen had been increased, life as we know it could not exist. The distance from the earth to the sun. If the earth were 1% away from the sun, if the orbit of the earth were to be, to be forcibly moved 1% away, the earth would either be too cold or too hot for life as we know it to exist. The conditions that are necessary for life to exist are so perfect. God tells us to think about it over and over again. He says, look at the world around you. Do you see any flaw? Do you see any mistake? In another verse, God challenges us, look again. Look again. This is a verse of the Quran. Look again and see. Do you find a crevice, a crack, a flaw? You're not going to find anything. In another verse, God says, this is the creation I have created. Show me. What is the creation of those whom you worship besides me? What have they created that you're going to worship them? So Islam does not emphasize the proofs of the existence of God. It's too self-evident. Rather, it jumps to a far more important and a far more controversial issue. And that is unifying this one God in worship. And this leads us to another point, and that is the definition of monotheism in Islam is radically different than the definition of monotheism for all other religions. Muslims believe, and this sounds very arrogant, but this is the truth. Muslims believe that they are the only monotheistic faith on this earth. They believe there is no other religion that is truly monotheistic. You open up the dictionary definition of monotheism and you say, the belief in one supreme God. And you say, hold on a second, that's not right. You're not the only monotheistic faith. Christians believe in one God. Many other religions believe in one supreme God. How can you take this term and say you exclusively are capable of using it? The response is, well, no doubt, Merriam-Webster might define, Merriam-Webster might define monotheism to be what it does, but the Qur'an defines it to be other than what Merriam-Webster does. And we take the definition of the Qur'an. The Qur'anic definition is not the belief in one supreme God. Because if this were the definition of monotheism, in reality, there is no religion that is not monotheistic on the face of this earth. The ancient Greeks believed in a multitude of God, a plethora of God. But there was one God who was the head God, the big cheese, the head honcho, Zeus himself. The ancient Romans had a plethora of gods, but there was Jupiter. Modern Hindus, and Hindus are the greatest manifestation of paganism, idol worship in our times. Modern Hindus, In the end of the day, they believe in one supreme God, Vishnu. It depends on which group you ask. Some say Brahma, some say Vishnu, some say Krishna. But they all believe, all of them, all of the subgroups of Hinduism believe that all of these other sub-gods, demigods, semi-gods, originated from the one Brahma, or the one Vishnu, or the one Krishna. So even they acknowledge that deep down there is one God who is the God of gods, the supreme God. If you were to take the Merriam-Webster dictionary of definition of monotheism, the reality is that pretty much every religion that you look at on the face of this earth is monotheistic. But that's not the Quranic definition of monotheism. The Quranic definition of monotheism, firstly, unifies God in His being, and secondly, unifies our worship of that God. And this is the profound difference in the Quranic definition and the dictionary definition of monotheism. To believe in one all-perfect, supreme, unified God. Here, some religions might qualify. Some, indeed. Hinduism, okay, they would not qualify because they believe in a plethora of gods. In this definition, that one supreme, unique, all-powerful God. Some religions might qualify. But then when you get to the other point, and that is, and to unify Him in your acts of devotion and worship. In other words, to worship none save that one God who created you. And this is where the Quranic definition and the dictionary definition of monotheism absolutely collide. Because for the Muslim, to worship the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, would make him automatically, ipso facto, a non-Muslim. If a Muslim were to come and to prostrate to our Prophet Muhammad, or he were to say, "Oh Muhammad, forgive me. Oh Muhammad, grant me salvation. Save me, oh Muhammad." If a Muslim were to say that, that act of his would disqualify him from being a Muslim. Why? Because he has contradicted the very crux of Islam, the very gist of Islam, which is the testimony of faith, La ilaha illallah, which I'm sure you have heard many times in the course of today's many lectures. There is no deity that is worthy of our worship other than Allah. This is the crux of our belief. This is the fundamental pillar upon which all other pillars revolve around. If this pillar is not met, even if it is not met by contradicting it via our Prophet Muhammad, it doesn't matter how you contradict it. If you direct an act of worship to other than God, if you pray, you prostrate, you sacrifice, you invoke, you have a relationship with any being that is an exclusive right of God's, then you have contradicted that testimony of faith. There is no object, no being, no substance that is worthy of our worship, our veneration, our love, our fear, our hope, other than the one who created me. Including the prophets of God, including the angels. So this is the crux of our religion, and this is why Muslims say, yes, we are the only monotheistic religion, because our definition of monotheism is more than just the dictionary definition of monotheism. So the purpose of life is indeed the worship of God. Now, what does it mean to worship God? Here too, the Muslims have a different definition of worship. When I say the word worship, I bet you the first picture you have in mind is what? Who can tell me? The first picture you have in mind when I say worship? Pray. Prostrate. Bow down to. No doubt, that is worship. Nobody's denying that. But in Islam, the concept of worship is broader than that. Yes, prayer is a very important type of worship. No doubt. In fact, in one prophetic narration, he said, prayer is the gist or the essence of worship. The one whom you pray to, you invoke. When I say pray here, I mean call out to for your needs. Okay, you're invoking. This is the essence of worship, because no single act better illustrates the relationship between the worshipper and the object of his worship than prayer. Because you pray to the being whom you love and loves you. You pray to the being whom you know has the power to give you what you want. You pray to the being whom you know cherishes you. You pray to the being who you know hears you, sees you, knows you, cares about you. Therefore, the one whom you pray to, that is the one whom you have made a God. That is your God. So no doubt, you're right. Prayer is the gist of worship, even in Islam. But it is not the only manifestation of worship. Worship is far broader. It encompasses many, many, many facets of our life. So much so that smiling in the face of a person whom you greet is an act of worship. Helping your brother. In one narration, the Prophet said, when you take water from the well, this is the most common chore that people would do, right? In our times, it's a very heavy chore. Nobody does it. If anybody had to do it, it would be a very difficult chore. You go to the well and you pull water out. That is not something we want to do. In those days, they'd have to do that 20, 30, 40 times a day. He said to pull water from that well and then to pour your bucket into your brother's bucket. You give him that water. This is an act of worship as well. To remove an act, to remove some substance that's irritating people. To remove, basically, to clean the road. To remove that litter from the road is an act of worship, an act of charity. So you see, the concept of worship is also different in Islam. Being good to human beings is one of the best acts of worship. And here is where the Islamic definition of worship is again radically different than any other, than many other. Not all, some other religions say, but many other religions. In that, for the Muslim, there are acts of worship that are due to God, such as prayer, fasting, sacrifice. And that is the most important. And then there are acts of worship that you can do for the sake of God, but yes, your fellow men are involved. Primary amongst them is to be good to your parents. This is the highest level of servitude that you show to any human being. No human being has the level that your parents do in Islam. And then obviously to your spouse, your children, your brothers and sisters, you know, fellow men. And then there's also acts of worship that you do for yourself. You take care of your body even. And that is an act of worship. There are three, if you like, spheres of worship. Between you and God, with your fellow man, and with yourself. And in Islam, you have to perfect all three. If a person were to perfect only one of these three, they're falling short. And this is where we would disagree with many humanists, secular or religious, who claim the purpose of creation is to be good to man. No, this is not the ultimate purpose of creation. The ultimate purpose of creation is to worship God. And worshiping God, one of the manifestations of that worship is to be good to your fellow men. Yes, but to restrict this to being good to men, you are neglecting the rights of God. If somebody were to show you a favor, and instead of repaying him back, you repay somebody else back, that's not very nice. The one who has created you, the one who has given you all that you have, to reject him, to neglect him, to not care about him, it doesn't matter if you do other acts of good. They will be rewarded, nobody's saying they won't be, but you have forfeited his pleasure by ignoring and neglecting him. So the greatest act of worship, no doubt, is the worship of God himself. Then after that, a part of worship is to help your fellow men. And in this regard, any act of charity, any act of good that brings about good to mankind is an act of worship. In one prophetic tradition, the Prophet is reported to have said, the best of people are those who benefit the people the most. The best of people are those who benefit the people most. Meaning, once you do believe in God and you are a righteous person in your daily life, if you want to excel over others, you need to be good to your fellow men. So the concept of monotheism is different in Islam, and the concept also of worship is also different. One more aspect, and that is that, and then we'll open the floor for Q&A and for a discussion, and that is, one thing about Islam that many people simply don't understand is that we also believe one manifestation of worship is to submit to the laws of God. We believe that Islam is not just dry theology, not just cut and paste, believe in this, believe in that, believe in this, believe in that. No. We believe that the one who created us is the only one who can really and truly tell us how to live our lives. Nobody, nobody is better qualified to tell us what to do and what not to do, what to eat and what not to eat, how to marry and divorce, how to leave our inheritance, how to live our national, international lives than God. And this is where the concept of separating the church and state, for example, the Muslims, as I'm sure by now all of you know, the Muslims believe that our lives are governed by God. There is no separation in that sense, that I live my life according to the laws of God. I render unto Caesar's what is Caesar's, I render unto God what is God's, but there should be no contradiction between the two. They have to go hand in hand, because Caesar is but a servant of God. And so when the commandment of Caesar goes against the commandment of my God, that is where obviously issues arise. I have to live my life according to the laws of God. Now, one manifestation of worship, as we said, is to submit to those laws. Therefore, for the Muslim, a Muslim believes that a true religion has to not just be cut and dry theology, but also it has to be a system of governance, a system of ethics, of morality. The one who tells us who he is must also tell us what is moral and immoral, what is ethical and what is unethical. In fact, it is a logical consequence of a God being a God. Nobody is more, when I say buddy here, I mean nobody meaning no being. Perhaps not the wisest thing to use when you're referring to God, but no being is more qualified to dictate to us how to live our lives. Man cannot even judge himself. And we all see for ourselves what happens when the majority, quote-unquote, doctrines rule. Many of you who are practicing Christians, you all know what happens when, for example, with abortion, with other issues that we all feel very strongly about. Even men are not qualified to judge themselves, because the people who become in charge, as we all know very well, that power gets to them. And they start abusing and misusing that power. It's just only natural. And that is why in Islam, the concept of a government, it's a very different concept. The laws are already up and running. The laws are already there. The laws have been revealed. It's a very different system of government. Because the government is not there to take power for itself. The government is there to make sure that the laws that are already there are implemented. And that is where a radical difference occurs as well. Now, of course, this leads us to the issue of Muslim minorities living in lands such as America. That is a separate topic. And I just gave a talk recently, I'll be giving a talk again tonight, where I say in all honesty that yes, we are a minority in this country. Therefore, these views have to remain theoretical. We must respect the law of the land. We have to understand that our rights here are rights as citizens. We're not expecting to implement our laws internationally or nationally. But within the realm of my personal life, the Constitution guarantees the freedom for me to be religious in my personal life, and that is what we want to do. And that's something we're talking about on a pragmatic or a civic level, if you like. But I'm talking about the theoretical level. Theoretically, a religion should provide not just theology, but also ethics and morality and an entire legal frame of mind. All of that comes part and parcel with the concepts of monotheism and the concepts of worship. So with that, if there are any questions of discussion, any issues that I can help clarify, I don't need it to be written down. If you want to write it, that's fine. If you want to ask it, that's fine as well. Yes, in the back. That's a very profound question. The response to this is, there are many gods that are worshipped by men, but none of those gods deserves to be a god. So what is a god? And again, this all goes back to semantics, to definitions. What is a god? Again, I don't know the Merriam-Webster dictionary, the definition, so I can't quote it, but I'll tell you from an Islamic perspective. A god is a person or even a concept or a thing that is shown veneration, that is shown worship. Any object that is shown worship becomes a god. Now, whether it's worthy of worship or not is a separate issue. Okay? But an idol is a god. In Islam, we would call it an ilah, which is a god. We would call it a god. But does that idol deserve to be a god? No. So the meaning of our testimony, there is no being that is worthy of being worshipped other than God, other than Allah. So there are many gods, if you like, small g's. There are many gods out there. But none of them deserves to be a god. None of them is worthy of that status other than the one true God. Does that answer your question? Okay. We'll take one question from here. I guess we'll alternate between one written and one. Yeah. When I said a manifestation of worship is sacrifice, what do you mean? I didn't mean human sacrifice or something of this nature. I meant that, I should have clarified here, because the word sacrifice has very different connotations in different religions. What I meant was that for Muslims, when we kill an animal to eat it, goats, sheep, whatever you eat, whatever animal you eat, we're not allowed to take the life of that animal. That life is sacred. We don't have the right to take the life of that animal unless we mention the name of God. So we have to consecrate. It's very similar to kosher laws where, you know, the rabbi has to come and he has to bless, if you like. He has to say, God, I'm doing this for you. I mean, I don't have the right to take this life unless you have given me this right. And we Muslims believe God has created animals for us in that sense, that he has given us the blessings to eat their meat. But I don't have the right to take that animal's life without mentioning God's name. And so to sacrifice an animal for the sake of God, meaning that I mention his name, this is an act of worship. To sacrifice an animal without mentioning God's name, that's sinning. That's, you're taking a life without any reason. So that's what I meant. I hope that clarifies the point that I need to clarify. What does it mean to sacrifice in Islam? Any questions from the floor? The word spirit, once again, we need to define what do you mean by spirit. There is a spirit that is inherent in every single one of us. We call it a soul. And we believe that God created man in body and in soul. We have a physical body and we have something, call it inside of us, or even though we don't know what the dimensions of, you know, we don't know whether it's inside us, but we have something called a soul, a spirit that God has given to every single human being. And life and death is the entering and exiting of that spirit. When the spirit leaves the body becomes a corpse. It's the whole point of what life and death is. So if you're referring to that spirit, obviously this is given to all of us. And God says in the Quran that when He created Adam from clay, that was the body, He then blew of His spirit into Adam. So there is something about this spirit that has a connection with God. And that's why we believe that God takes care of us both in body and in soul. The one who provides our food and drink and air will also provide for our spiritual needs as well. That's the purpose of there being a God. If you mean by spirit, the spirit with a capital S, the Quran also refers to a spirit, just like the New Testament refers to a spirit. For Christians and for Muslims, the spirit means radically different things. Or maybe it doesn't, depending on which understanding you follow. For Muslims, the spirit is none other than the angel Gabriel. This is the spirit, the spirit with a capital S, okay? The spirit of God in that sense is the angel Gabriel. So the spirit that God sends down to the prophets is the best of all angels, the angel Gabriel. There is no angel that is holier or more close to God than the angel Gabriel. And his whole purpose of existence is to communicate between God and the prophets of God. And so when God sends his spirit to these men, he is sending the angel Gabriel to them. And that is our understanding of spirit. As you are very well familiar, the Christian understanding is very different than that. That doesn't mean, though, by the way, that God is not a moving force in our lives. Quite the contrary. Without God, we would not live for a millisecond. You know, how? He is our provider and creator and sustainer. I mean, the very air that we breathe, God consciously wills us for us to breathe it. He is fully taking care of us for every single millisecond of our lives. I mean, without God, there is no life. One of the meanings of Lord in the Arabic language, one of the meanings of Lord is cherisher and sustainer, the one who takes care of me. So without God, there is no life. So there is no, it's not a question of how, it's a question of why, when and when not. If God doesn't take care of you, as God says in one verse in the Quran, my mercy encompasses every single aspect of creation. Nothing exists except that God's mercy is surrounding it. If God's mercy were not a part of where we are, of what we're doing, we wouldn't be able to live. Nothing can exist without the mercy of God. Even the enemies of God, God has to provide for them. Even those who deny God, they belie Him with their tongues. But God will feed them and take care of them because He is the one who provides and sustains and nourishes. So that is the physical taking care of. God also takes care of the elite of people spiritually, not all of them. Spiritually, He will take care of those who want to turn to God. Anyone who wants to be sincere in his worship of God, God will take care of him, not just in body, but in soul as well. But God does not come down or indwell within us, if that's what you're referring to or something. We as Muslims believe, no, God is distinct from the creation. He takes care of us, His mercy descends, and we're surrounded by it, but He Himself is distinct from us. Nor does He come down or dwell within us. Okay, we'll take one from here. This is a personal question. Why are you studying at Yale if you see so little value in philosophy? I believe that philosophy is a science whose basic premise is flawed. The basic premise of philosophy is that via man's intellect, the ultimate truths of life can be arrived at. There is no need for inspiration from God. And I believe that no, that's simply not true. Unless and until we have the revelation from God, we're not going to arrive at the ultimate truths of life. And the greatest indication of this is that there have been hundreds of thousands of philosophers in the history of man. And if you ever study philosophy, you must study hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. And no two of them, from the time of the pre-Socratic Greek philosophers until our modern living philosophers, no two of them ever agree on any fundamental point of life or death or ethics or morality or anything. How can this possibly be true when every single philosopher propounds a different theory of everything? If any philosopher were to come and agree with the previous philosopher, he wouldn't even be famous. He wouldn't be worth studying, right? You would be nobody. So in order to do something, he has to go against everybody. Okay? And here you have, you know, certain philosophers who become famous merely because they know they exist. You know, I'm referring to who here? Not Galileo. Descartes. Descartes became famous in history because he proved to people he actually exists, right? I think, therefore, I am. And you have to ask yourself, if philosophers don't even know they exist, are they worthy of us studying their ideas? So, you know, I'm sorry, yes, I do think philosophers kind of have lost track of reality. And it's, you know, people have to sometimes point out the emperor with no clothes. Everybody's too scared of talking about philosophers because they're so daunted by their speech. Look, guys, let's be honest here. You pick up Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, you can be as intelligent as anything. You won't understand anything they're talking about. They're just going to go over your head. And then you go, and I've gone through the stage, that's why I'm speaking. When I was an undergraduate at University of Houston, I was in the Honors College, and you're supposed to study the great works, they called it. So we studied Plato and all of these people, and you know, I'm a freshman coming in, and I'm reading these books, and I mean, I always consider myself to be a very intelligent person. I got very high SAT scores and, you know, valedictorian in my high school and everything. I'm reading these books, I'm like, what is he talking about? And I show up in class, and everybody seems to understand what's going on, except me. It's like, whoa, they all understand except me. And it took me many, many years to realize it's basically the emperor with no clothes. Everybody is scared to point out the obvious, which is, this stuff doesn't make any sense. It has no relevance to our lives. It has nothing to do with me as a human being. What is the meaning of concepts and forms and living in caves and shadows? That's Aristotle here. What has it got to do with anything? It's not going to make me a better person or make me understand how to live or provide for my family or anything. Somebody has to say it bluntly. And so in order to say that, I need to study it. And I say, I speak from experience. I know what I'm talking about. It's not something that I have no clue what it is. I know it and I'm studying it. And also, I'm not just studying philosophy at Yale. My PhD is Islamic Studies. Therefore, I'm studying Islamic Studies. In the course of my Islamic Studies, I am personally concentrating on philosophy as well because I find it very interesting coming from a different perspective now. Not coming as a student. Coming, in my humble opinion, as an outside observer now. I'm not affected by the views of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates and Descartes and Hume and Nietzsche. I'm not affected by them. But I read them and I see where they're coming from. And honestly, I feel a bit of empathy and sympathy for them. You know, because most of them live very miserable lives. They couldn't... That's the again, I'm not making this up. You know, they themselves live very miserable lives. They never found these eternal truths. Read about Nietzsche, read about Socrates and how he died and Plato and whatnot. I mean... Somebody has to just point out the emperor is naked, and if that has to be me, then so be it. Any questions from the floor? Yes.